History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to take the initiative to ask some questions and, of course, to take the time to patiently listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to spend our hour together listening to the memories of a man who was truly one of a kind. Every veteran we've had the privilege of meeting on Hometown Heroes over the years leaves a unique impression on us, but few veterans have ever shared their stories as freely, as frequently, and as powerfully as Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley, who passed away at the start of this month, just 3 months shy of his 100th birthday. There will be a special memorial service for Stu aboard the USS Midway Museum in San Diego on August 25th at 9 a.m. And today's episode is a chance for us to honor his special legacy by listening to his story as he told it. We'll start out with the day he started his 20-year Navy career, which he had to work up to. He'd initially been denied enlistment because he was too small. But some time chopping down trees in a CCC camp in upstate New York allowed Stu to add some muscle while he grew a few more inches.
I was 5'2", eyes of blue, 122 pounds, hitchhiked the Buffalo New York, and on August 20th, 1940, I shipped into the Navy. Mm-hmm. So off to Newport, Rhode Island I went. I was a wise guy.
Never would have guessed.
And I smarted off to the chief. That was the wrong thing to do. He told me, he says, grab your rifle, put it up over your head, run 11 laps around the field. I collapsed and dropped the rifle, and I thought, you aren't going to smart off to any more chiefs. So I was there from August till October. And October the 23rd, the chief got us all together and told us where we were being assigned to. Well, there were about 40 of us that were going to the West Coast, to the USS West Virginia. Well, I asked the chief, I didn't smart off to him, but I asked him, why in the world do they send us all the way to the Pacific coast when we're right here on the Atlantic? Why don't they send, that's so you can't go home every night. Well, it made sense. So I got aboard the USS West Virginia, beautiful battleship. When I went aboard the West Virginia, I went aboard on my birthday, October 29th, 1940. And I wasn't dry behind the ears yet, and I was still a cocky little guy. And I made my way to the pilot house. And when I got there, the officer deck said, what's your name, son? I says, Stuart Headley. Where's the steering wheel? He says, the what? I says, the steering wheel. He says, you're looking at it. And it was like a streetcar controller.
Right.
And in 2 weeks, I'm going to be on that. But it's called a helm, not a steering wheel. So I was a helmsman. Well, first of all, when we got aboard the Weavey, a bunch of my buddies said, Stu, let's go to Hollywood. I said, nope. Well, how about Los Angeles? Nope. Well, where are you going? I'm going to hitchhike to San Diego. I says, we were supposed to move out here in 1934. With the Consolidated Aircraft. My father worked for Reuben Fleet. And my stepmother would not go because her mother was 93 and she was ill. Mm. And so Reuben and the whole family and practically everybody that worked for him came out here. And so I hitchhiked down here to San Diego. And I got on the bus and I said, would you take me out to La Jolla? He says, son, it's not La Jolla, it's La Jolla. And he's, if you're going out east, it's not El Cajon, it's El Cajon. I got a lesson in education. Hurry. Well, I walked all around the receiving station, and it was beautiful. The flowers were treated, the grass was mowed, and the buildings were so far removed from what it was in Newport, Rhode Island, because they were all brick, and they had been there for ages. And as I was walking down Rosecrans Boulevard, I said, Lord, if I ever retire, I want to retire here in San Diego. Forgot all about it. Mm-hmm. Well, when I got back aboard ship, the chief told us we're getting underway on January 3rd for the Panama Canal. We're joining the Atlantic Fleet. Well, I learned on January the 3rd, orders can change in 5 minutes because we were up anchoring, pulling up both anchors, and the captain, Captain Goodall, announced over the loudspeaker, our orders have been changed. Instead of going to the Atlantic, we're going straight to Pearl Harbor. The whole fleet was moving to Pearl. I was excited because I wanted to go out to Pearl anyhow. So we got out there on January the 8th. The chief got us all together in the 3rd Division. I had a new name, which was Ham, from the time that I came down from the pilot house. They would want me to fall into quarters to assign me to a division. And they assigned me to the 3rd Division. Ensign Harris, sharp man right out of the academy, said to each one of us, he assigned us our battle station. And my battle station, Headley, you're going to be a gun pointer on main battery. That's the 16-inch cannons that you see. But we'll train you, because we know that you're just new aboard. And Croslin, you're going to be the trainer. You're going to train the ship out. And then he selected Kansen back, who was a first-class boatswain mate, gun captain, and he was the gun boss. So we have two 16-inch guns to a turret with a 4-inch steel partition between them. Well, when we got to Pearl, the chief told us we're going to spend more time at sea than we are in port. And he says, let me explain that to you. Admiral Yarnell and Admiral Richardson established a policy that there's to be only one battle fleet in Pearl at a time. There's three battle fleets out here. Two will be out in training and exercising. We adhered to that till Thursday before the attack. Thursday, all 9 battleships were in port. However, the Pennsylvania was in dry dock.
Right.
The Utah, which was a converted battleship, was tied up over on the western side of the island where the Enterprise was supposed to be on Saturday. But because they ran into a storm, they had to fuel 4 destroyers. They were a day late.
Good thing.
Yep. No carriers were in port.
And let me ask you about that, Stu. I don't want to ruin your momentum here. You tell your story so well. But when you say that you guys adhered to that, I mean, this is almost a full year where every time you're going out, they keep this pattern, only one fleet in harbor at a time.
Yep.
Until 3 days before December 7th. What do you make of that? Do you read something into that or no?
Sure. I didn't understand it, but I met Commander Fushida, who led the attack on Pearl, and he's the one that clued me in. The first words out of his mouth, I was interviewing him for radio, KECR. Bill Clark was the station manager.
About what year was this?
72.
I knew you'd know.
Yeah. Because I met him that year at Hoover High School. I was with Youth for Christ. And Dr. Gene French, who was the director, I was one of his counselors for the boys. He said, Stu, I got somebody I want you to meet. I says, who's that? I'm not going to tell you. I'll take you backstage and introduce you to him. So he took me backstage. He said, I want you to meet the man that led the attack on Pearl Harbor. I says, Commander Fushida. He says, what ship were you on? I says, the USS West Virginia. Why do you ask? I was out to kill you. I says, you almost did it. He said, Stuart, if your country doesn't learn from its mistakes, it's going to repeat them. I said, explain that to me. Genda, myself, Admiral Yamamoto, and Tojo, all trained in Harvard University in the 1930s. Admiral Yamamoto was a naval attaché. We had access to all of your naval armament. That's how I knew that your battleships had armor belts, the thickness of the size guns that your ship carried. That's why I had to redesign the torpedoes for shallow water and for that. And I thought to myself, you know, we don't learn. And as we found out, all five of those pilots that crashed in New York trained right here at Miramar. So as we were discussing, he brought out the fact, Stuart, I got something else I want to share with you. What's that? On November 26th, we left the Kuril Islands with six aircraft carriers, two battleships, two heavy cruisers, 13 destroyers, and five giant submarines, each carrying a midget sub, along with the oilers and the auxiliary ships with us. But what you don't know is that on that very day, taking in consideration the international dateline, orders came out of your White House to Admiral Kimmel and General Short, prepare for sabotage. That's why 187 airplanes were out on the field, lined up wingtip to wingtip. That's why all nine battleships were in port. But there were 96 ships in that harbor. I believe with all my heart, Roosevelt died on his conscience what happened at Pearl Harbor. And if you follow back, you'll realize he died of a cerebral hemorrhage. That's where the brain explodes. But I also point out the clue to the attack on Pearl Harbor was in his fireside chats, because he would always say at the close of his broadcast, Eleanor hates war, fella hates war, that's my daughter, Scotty, and I hate war. I'll never put this country into war unless we are attacked first. That was the clue.
When you talk about Roosevelt's desire to get into war and that he died with that on his conscience, correct me if I'm wrong. I just listening to you talk, I get the sense that you think he was hoping there would be some kind of attack, but that perhaps he didn't know how great the loss of life would be.
That was the thing. When he found out 2,000 some odd sailors and Marines were killed, I think it hit him pretty hard. But yet, you look at it this way, being that I was in the service, all those battleships are dreadnoughts. The maximum speed would be 21 knots against an airplane traveling 300 and some odd. Now, I've heard many people say Pearl Harbor was a defeat. I don't agree with them. My opinion is it was an eye-opener, because the minute Nimitz took command, he followed Admiral Yamamoto's procedure. He built the battle fleet around the aircraft carrier.
Big change in strategy.
Yes. And you see, the aircraft had come into its own. It was amazing, because in talking to Fushida, he clued me in that instead of using conventional bombs, which would never penetrate five steel decks to get to our handling rooms, he used armor-piercing shells and 15-inch armor-piercing shells. And in the torpedo deal, where we've got 35 and 40 feet of water in the harbor, he redesigned the torpedo by taking the elevator and the rudder off, which are steel, and put wooden ones on to give it buoyancy.
Yeah.
But then we've got a 16-inch armor belt from the after steering to the anchor windlass room. He's got to get through that. So he put a double warhead on the torpedo. In doing that, it stretch the torpedo out, so when they dropped them from the air, instead of going down 50 feet under the water, they went about 20, 25 feet underwater. When they were coming at us, we could see them coming through the water.
It's time for our first break, but we'll hear much more about December 7th, 1941, when this special memorial edition of Hometown Heroes continues. We're remembering Stu Headley, an ambassador for veterans everywhere, and especially for his fellow Pearl Harbor survivors. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.